Okay, good evening. Welcome, everyone, to the 529 Emergency Preparedness Discussion Net, courtesy of the WA7ABU 529 repeater. This is Kilo Golf 7 Golf Delta Bravo. My name is Brett, and I'm net control for today, April 20th, 2020. This net meets each Tuesday evening from 7 to 8 p.m. local time on 145.29 megahertz. This is designated emergency frequency, so we'll break if any real emergency occurs. Our alternate frequency is 145.19 with a tone of 100. We appreciate those who stand by and allow us to have a clear frequency for the next hour as we discuss emergency preparedness with particular emphasis on the COVID-19 pandemic. Now, let's see. Let me get a drip. Okay, so unfortunately, Dr. Sun cannot be with us tonight, and we'll bring up our first topic for tonight. Her mother was on hospice, and she passed away today, and it was a long night where she was up all night sort of answering questions on the telephone and things like that, so she didn't really get much sleep. But she said she will come back on Friday and handle the tough questions, but we'll do the best we can to answer tonight. I can do the answering. We can I'll take down any questions that you're not satisfied with my answer. We'll revisit them again on Friday. So the announcement is that Sheila is not here tonight. I'll be here, and we'll still have the discussion if people will join us. We'll still make a recording of it, and we'll try to come back and do it again. That being said, let's continue on, and we'll get people checked in. All amateur operators are welcome to participate in the COVID-19 discussions and other emergency-related topics related to the pandemic. We'll start with checking in stations that would like to participate or maybe just listen in on the discussions. If you want to ask a question, let me know. And then after, I want to introduce the topic tonight, which has to do with healthcare in general during the time of COVID, because this is what happened to us. I'll relate what happened to our family, and you can understand a little bit. I think it's an important topic to begin with, just knowing how healthcare is working right now. Anyway, when you check in, please identify with your call sign slowly and phonetically, and also your name and location to be recognized by net control. I'll start with those people on Echolink that would like to check in for the emergency preparedness net. Okay, not hearing anyone on Echolink. Let's take general check-ins for the emergency preparedness net.
Kilo Golf 7, Oscar Whiskey November. This is Jerry in Dallas, Oregon, and I will just be listening.
Good evening, Brett. Kilo Alpha 7, Juliet Lima Oscar, Jeff in Albany.
K6, Sierra Tango X-ray, Deanna Kiter.
W7, November Alpha Tango, Nate, South Salem.
Kilo 7, Alpha Romeo Tango, Arden Canby.
Whiskey 7, India Sierra Echo, Mike in Carlton.
Kilo Foxtrot 6, Foxtrot Yankee Delta, Richard Salem.
W1, Alpha Romeo Kilo, Robert in Salem.
Whiskey 7, Lima Alpha Whiskey, Jane, Carlton.
K7, Juliet Charlie Delta.
Whiskey 7, Charlie Mike, Bruce.
Let's pause. So just for a second there, because I didn't get Jane in Carlton. She was new to the log here. Could you come back, Jane, with your call sign again, please?
Whiskey 7, Lima Alpha Whiskey, Jane, Carlton.
Okay, Okay. Thank you, Jane, for checking in tonight. We have another Lima Alpha Whiskey, David, who checks in, and I knew that wasn't you. Thanks for your patience there. Let me go back through the list of people who've checked in, and then I'll take some more check-ins. We had Bruce, Whiskey 7, Charlie, Mike. We had John came before that, Kilo 7, Juliet, Charlie, Delta. Robert, Whiskey 1, Alpha Romeo, Kilo. Richard, Kilo Foxtrot 6, Foxtrot Yankee, Delta. Mike, Whiskey 7, India Sierra Echo. Art, Kilo 7, Alpha Romeo, Tango. Nate checked in, Whiskey 7, November, Alpha Tango. Dan, Kilo 6, Sierra Tango X-ray. Jeff, Kilo Alpha 7, Juliet Lima Oscar, and Jerry started us off there. Kilo Golf 7, Oscar Whiskey November. Thank you all for checking in. Who else wants to check in?
KE7, DRY, Juliet Taves.
Kilo 5, Charlie Papa, Charlie Mike, and Happy Valley.
KE7, Victor Whiskey X-ray, listening. Thank you.
Kilo 7, Mike, Juliet, Bravo, Michael.
Kilo India 7, Foxtrot Whiskey Hotel, Alan. And Kilo India 7, Foxtrot Whiskey Papa, Jennifer, South Salem.
Okay, there's a pause in the action there. That was Alan and Jennifer, Kilo India 7, Foxtrot Whiskey Hotel, and Kilo India 7, Foxtrot Whiskey Papa. Before that was Mike, Kilo 7, Mike Juliet Bravo. We had Everett, Kilo Echo 7, Victor Whiskey X-ray. Mike in Happy Valley, Kilo 5, Charlie Papa, Charlie. And Joette, welcome, Kilo Echo 7, Delta Romeo Yankee. It's Nate's wife, and good to hear you on here. Thank you for checking in. Does anybody else want to check in for the Emergency Prep Net?
Kilo Foxtrot 7, Golf November, this is Scott in Corvallis.
Hotel November. Frank in Lebanon.
Oh, we got a pause there for a second. Frank got the Whiskey 7 Victor Hotel November, but then Scott, you got you were doubling. So could you come back with your call again, please?
Sure, it's Kilo Foxtrot 7 Golf November.
Okay, gotcha. Kilo Foxtrot 7 Golf November. Was there anybody else in there I'd like to check in?
Alpha 7, Hotel Sierra Bravo, Gary Silverton.
Hi, Brett. This is Whiskey 0, Echo Delta Foxtrot, Richard and Tiger.
Okay, that was Richard, Whiskey 0, Echo Delta Foxtrot, Richard, and Jerry, Whiskey Alpha 7, Hotel Sierra Bravo. Okay, let's see. Again, I'm going to pause here for our check-ins for just a minute here. And again, this is a special announcement. We don't have Dr. Sun today on the net. She said she will return on Friday. And the reason why is that we had a death in the family. Sheila's mother died today. And it was a pretty long night, and they kept calling her all night long, so she's pretty exhausted. But she did not die from COVID-19, and I thought what I'd like to talk about first here tonight is our experience with this and how, as a part of emergency preparedness, how healthcare is handling this crisis. And I have to say that it wasn't a great experience, but let me just give you basically a synopsis of what happened with her mother. Now, her mother is, let me get a drip here, I'll start the story and try not to be too long-winded. So Sheila's mother is 88 years old. She lives by herself in Los Angeles, San Fernando Valley area, and yeah, she's been living on her own and fine. She didn't drive, but she had plenty of, she has neighbors that help her and people that help her shop and things like that. She goes to her doctor's appointments, takes all her medications. And about 2 weeks ago, she started feeling ill. She called up and said, I just don't feel very good. And she was not doing well. She was, you know, didn't seem to be communicating very well. Her speech was a little slurred, or she was acting very tired. And, you know, it was difficult to see what was going on. She was, you know, not eating very much. And so we tried to figure out what was going on, and she just kept getting kind of sicker and you know, actually was having mental issues. We thought she'd had a stroke. And, you know, so it was difficult, first of all, we had to sort of call the doctors, and there's no clinics that are open for her to go into. And, again, she's not driving, and so, you know, we would have to, she didn't really want to go to the doctor, of course, and, but I said, you know, there's something wrong with you, and so eventually, I think after the next day after that, she actually stopped answering the phone, and we sent the neighbor over, and they kind of broke the door open and found her basically just not doing anything. She looked really sick. They called 911, and they took her to a hospital down in Los Angeles, where they admitted her to the emergency room. Of course, the first thing they did was give her a COVID test and put her, you know, in a room and worked up the problem. She did not have a hands-on exam from people. They determined, did some blood tests, and determined that she had a very, very low hemoglobin. So she had been bleeding internally. That was what was wrong with her. She was dehydrated and bleeding internally, probably. They didn't know where or what. She, you know, she takes a blood thinner, like a lot of you guys probably do. Well, during the time she was in the hospital there, she had already had talked about the fact that she really didn't want to, you know, at this point in her life to go through surgeries and extensive kinds of treatments and things like that. But basically, didn't have very good care. Didn't really examine her other than give her the blood tests, of course, the COVID test, which came back negative. But that didn't really change her care. She was pretty much left alone. She was pretty miserable in her room without any visitors. No visitors allowed in the hospital. And, you know, she kept calling us instead of the nurses weren't coming. You know, they didn't really want to come and see her. And, you know, she was confused and left alone. So that was not a good situation. Then we, you know, she had other medical problems, and they wanted to work them up and find out, well, why doesn't she have good pulmonary function, and we should, you know, look at her heart and do various things. And she said, I didn't want to do that. So she checked out, you know, against medical advice, said we'd need to get back to a regular doctor where she could follow up, because she had a known lung illness. She had pulmonary hypertension, and she's been treated for that. So got her back home. And with a home health aide to take care of her just over the last weekend there. So the story goes that she, you know, she was okay for, got a little bit better, but then was very short of breath and really had no reserve capacities. And talking to her doctor, said, well, if she gets any worse, bring her to UCLA, where that her pulmonologist said that she would admit her. And she said, I don't care about, you know, she said, we'll take care of her. So, but when they took her to UCLA and they got her in there, they gave her another COVID test, okay? So, didn't believe the first one, but, yeah, that one came back negative, too. Well, anyway, she, did very poor pulmonary function, and even though that she'd had this, she did have blood transfusion in the previous hospital, which made her feel better. But basically couldn't really, again, nobody really looked at her or examined her for what was wrong. They finally were just like, we just don't understand why she's doing so poorly. And they said, well, maybe we should do a CAT scan of her. And they did, you know, did a CAT scan and found a big old malignant tumor in her abdomen. And wow, surprise, surprise. No one had ever mentioned that before. That was not a known condition. So basically, she had a bad cancer, and they said, well, you know, we're not going to do anything about that. you know, she's already not going downhill, and basically went on to hospice right away and became more and more unresponsive, and she passed away today. So the point was that, again, they were so worried about COVID, they really missed the fact of what was actually the first hospital, totally what was wrong with her. Not, it may not have changed the outcome, but the point is that in this day and age of COVID-19, you need to be aware that our medical system is not dealing well with the general health of the population. This is something you would normally be going to your doctor when you felt ill, and you would, that doctor would know you, and they would be trying to work up your problem. So this is not happening if the clinics are closed. So anyway, that was a kind of a quick and rapid hospice journey for us, and not something that was really expected that she would pass away so soon. But that is what happened. And you can't really blame COVID. She did not have COVID. And you can't, even though she was at all the criterion for a person at risk with breathing problems, a high white count, and they couldn't believe she didn't have COVID. Nope, she had cancer. Okay, so that's the first thing I wanted to bring up today. Is anybody have anybody here experienced any, degradation in your health care since this thing has started? Are you, getting taken care of for what you need looked after? Have you, tried to, had run into any barriers in terms of getting health care? Because, they're still supposed to see you if they can see you. And you have telehealth, but if you need to be seen, if you have an infection or something, you need to be seen by the doctor. How's it? What are people's experiences out there tonight? This is Kilo Golf 7, Golf Delta Bravo. Yeah, John, go ahead, please. Okay, so did that involve blood testing or anything? That's one of the things that we had to arrange because, they didn't know that what was wrong with this, with our, Sheila's mom. They managed to get an RN over to do a blood test at her house before she was admitted, but that's when they found that she had really low blood count there, and she obviously was not doing well. But did they arrange to, or maybe perhaps you don't need that degree of care, but did the telemedicine work for you, or do you feel like you should have been seen?
No, the appointment isn't for another week.
W7NAT.
Okay, yeah. So, Nate, go ahead with your comment.
Well, my wife Joette and myself had a 6-month checkup. We had our blood test, and the doctor called me. He wanted to have a virtual meeting again, so we had one. But it was fine because we already knew, even before he called us, what our blood results were, and they were just fine. So it worked out okay for us.
How did you get a virtual blood test, K6SDX?
No, we did not get a virtual blood test. We got a real blood test.
Well, that means you had to go to the doctor.
Well, but not for a doctor visit, just for a visit with the blood draw.
CPC.
Okay, so I think Nate is saying there that the clinic was opened for the lab part of it was open, and so he was able to do that. Go ahead, Mike, with your comment.
Yeah, we're in quarantine here, and I'm required, I take the INR test, blood draw about once a month, and the nurse came out, we opened the garage door, we set up a table and a chair, I wore a mask, she wore a mask, we took the blood draw, I had several other tests run for my blood tests. I immediately went into the laundry room, took up all my clothes, went into the shower, and we are still 100% quarantined.
Okay, very good. So, again, having some home visits there is really, you know, there's some things you just, yeah, you can't have a virtual blood test. That's not going to work unless, you know, I know there's other people out there, like Richard said, I think he has diabetes, and he has his own blood, you know, you as a diabetic, you're taught to check your own blood sugars, for example. So some people can do that if you have a known problem. You're set up already for that. But, you know, if you become acutely ill, so in this case, you know, if you didn't know that, if you just look at the fact that you have an old person who is suddenly is very fatigued and, you know, has no energy and is short of breath and has some symptoms that might indicate an infection, you know, you think, oh, well, she's got COVID, right? But that's basically what's happening is that people are like, oh, well, if you... You know, everybody's got to have COVID that's coming into the hospital, and, you know, we're going to treat them accordingly, meaning hands off, and, you know, we'll, the actual level of care is such that, yeah, if someone had, I think in a normal case, if you came into a hospital and you were, you know, you would get with an unresolved, like, bleeding, that they would do some more examinations and try to figure out what was the cause of that. If you need to have, you know, a couple of units of blood, something's going on, right? A physical exam might be warranted or something. But they were, I think the doctor stood outside the door and, you know, said hello and talked to her from the door. Great. So anyway, anybody else have any, so I guess you survived your blood test there and you're back in. I have to say, everybody, you know, we're doing very well in Oregon. I mean, normally we start out by going over the numbers. We have flattened our curve in Oregon, you know, and people, I think everybody on this particular net is particularly clever, and you've listened quite well, and you're, you know, I don't know of anybody here who's gotten sick with COVID, and so you're taking excellent care of yourselves. And in general, Oregon is doing great at taking care of themselves. We do have a lot of cases in Marion County, if you look at the Oregon Health Authority, more per, like, 100,000 people than other counties around. But overall, our numbers are all quite low. Anybody else have any experience as far as their healthcare suffering or any anecdotes or any advice to people? How do you get taken care of when you don't have COVID and you need something else?
K6SDX.
Yeah, go ahead, Dan.
Yeah, this month I was supposed to go in and get my pacemaker checked, and they said they didn't want me. So they just put it off until June. So I guess they figured if I'm not going to have any trouble, that they're just going to put it off. So as far as I can know, I'm still not having troubles. But anyway, it's a... they don't even want me to come down there unless they absolutely have to.
Okay, very good. And again, I hope people are getting their, you know, are getting their medical care taken care of. You're not missing your prescriptions, that you're getting, you know, those places where you can pick up the pharmacies like Walgreens that have a drive-up window where you can pick things up and not, you know, have to go in, and a lot of medications can be delivered to you on a 90-day supply. So, you know, having unnecessary trips to go to various places is a risk. And, again, we're doing pretty good about reducing that, but I hope people are still getting the care they need. So There have been articles about this, and I, you know, I'm not going to go over them all, but that, you know, we've actually had, you know, people, you know, dying of heart attacks and things still, but because they're not going into the hospital. And they think that going to the hospital is not safe. And, you know, you do need to seek medical attention if you have a health problem. Don't don't neglect it. But they should see you if you've got something going on.
W7NAT.
Yes, Nate, go ahead.
I'm glad that the doctor did want to talk to us on the telephone because you take a blood test and it they don't get it done when you're there. You have to come back a week later or something like that. That's what you usually plan to do. So before we came back, though, we checked the internet on my chart, and indeed there was all the results of our blood tests, so we knew ahead exactly what the doctor was going to say, and he did.
Okay, very good. Well, I'm glad that worked well for you. Now, I'm going to bring up another point that's happened with this thing, is that the has to do with the telemedicine. Now, if you're sick and you're 88 years old, how good are you at doing telemedicine? I don't know how if all of you listening tonight would be comfortable with the idea, but basically that was what they told us. UCLA is like, oh, well, we need to talk to her. Can she go ahead and, you know, get on this, you know, she can do Zoom or she can do Google Groups or she could do some other, you know, app. And actually it turned out that although she had a smartphone and was a, was actively using it for texting, she really doesn't have email. She doesn't like getting the email on the phone, and really has been ignoring it. Like a lot of you guys have said, you have so much spam that she just didn't bother with email. So she texts her family when she wanted to do stuff, but she was not able to text, and she was also was having trouble holding the phone. And when she'd, you know, hold the phone against her face, so the smartphone, it touched her face and hung up on people and did things like that. So, you know, if you have someone who's sick, you know, you can't assume that they're going to be able to do this modern telemedicine stuff. You know, there's no way we could have talked her, you know, got her to do the anything more than a phone call. We managed to get her to do a conference call with my wife listening, and you know, her on the other end. I think they managed to do that through a regular, you know, telephone line. That was the best thing we could do. But when you're sick, you really can't talk on the phone. You really can't figure out how to work your computer. So that's the problem. How many of you have thought about that? If you feel comfortable with somebody says, hey, you know, we want to talk to you on your computer, can you do it?
I'd be lost right out of the bat in case like the FDA.
JCD.
Yeah, go ahead, John.
Well, I'm going to do it for the first time next week, so I'll let you know how it goes.
CPC.
Yeah, Mike, go ahead, please.
I just did it with Dr. Bear up at OHSU, and it went just fine. It's really not much different than the office. He just can't use his stethoscope. That's about the only difference.
They wanted to check my heart virtually over the internet type sort of thing. They said I needed a smartphone. Told them I didn't even own one. So they said, well, that was the end of that. You'll have to make it an appointment. And that's how it ended up in June, K6SDX.
Yep, well, and that's I think that's perfectly reasonable. You know, you don't, and the problem is if you're sick, you wouldn't be any better at it than you are right now, okay? So, again, I think that regular medicine, there's some things, yes, that are fine. Like if you have a appointment with a, you know, psychiatrist or something, you know, that's something that you could do with telemedicine. And, but I think that, you know, when we did the stay-at-home orders and we closed, you know, sort of elective practices, you know, your plastic surgeon's not going to see you right now. You know, that seemed to make sense. But, You know, for people that have ongoing medical problems and, you know, acute illnesses, they're still supposed to, you know, figure out a way to see you if you need to be seen. And that that seems to be not the case. It's that, oh, well, we will try to do anything possible short of seeing you if possible. And, you know, if they're really expecting you. And again, this is a person, they had been admitted to a hospital with, you know, low enough blood count that had to have transfused 2 units of blood, is home and now is, you know, very lethargic and unresponsive, and they want to do telemedicine with her. So, you know, they need to determine whether to admit her, you know. But, again, you can't you can't expect that someone who's sick is going to be able to adapt to the new system here. Anyway, this is Kilo Golf 7, Golf Delta Bravo, and this is the emergency preparedness net. And I just wanted you guys to realize that you need to either have an advocate for yourself or think about this a little bit in advance, because if this is going to go on, and it's going to go on for a while, because I'm going to talk about a little bit next about some antibody testing and things. Does anybody have any other questions or comments about, you know, adapting to the new version of medical care we have?
Kilo Golf 7, Oscar Whiskey November. This is Jerry in Dallas.
Yeah, go ahead, Jerry.
I had an appointment with Corvallis Clinic, and I'll be 88 here in October, and I have every 3 months they give me a mini physical. I have diabetes, but I'm type 2. And I wanted to know what my readings were, and I asked the doctor, I said, do I need to come in for this? And he said, oh, yes. So they moved him over to Albany. So I drove over to Albany, walk in. They take my temperature and sent me into the lab. I did blood work, went and saw the doctor, come home, and then he called me 2 days later, tells me my diabetes is numbers down around 6.8. He said, you're doing fine. Keep it up. Goodbye.
Okay. Well, you know, that's, again, I guess if you have any complications, though, don't hesitate to advocate for yourself and say, I need to be seen. Especially if it goes on for a while, and you might be fine. There's some people who have what's called brittle diabetes, and it's very difficult to control them, and they need to be have things adjusted more often. But the question really is again interesting that my mother-in-law here had cancer, and nobody realized it. That was quite interesting. We did not think that was the problem. So we were so focused on the fact that she had, you know, pulmonary hypertension and heart failure and potentially a stroke. You know, she had tons and tons of medicines. You're sure they're all very familiar with. She had her Coumadin, and she had, you know, all of her, she had rheumatoid arthritis, and she was on an immunosuppressive, and we thought, man, she's really going to get the COVID, but she did not. She was staying at home. She did not get COVID. You know, that is not what got her, and it just surprised everyone. So, anyway, let's go on here and see. Do we have any other check-ins tonight? I'll go ahead and take some more check-ins, and I want to talk a little bit. I have some experience as a medical researcher with understanding a little bit about validating of tests. I wanted to talk a little bit about these antibody tests. Sheila is more of an expert on it than I, and so if you're not satisfied with my response, you're welcome to wait till Friday and ask again. But I do want to go over what's happening. There's been some changes over the weekend here with antibody testing and some results out of Santa Clara. But let's take a few more check-ins if there is anybody.
Kilo Echo 7. Oscar Lima, Uniform, Paul, Portland.
Whiskey 7, Romeo, Golf, Mike, Reiner in Dallas.
Okay, well, there's Whiskey 7, Romeo Golf Mike, Reiner, and Paul, Kilo Echo 7, Oscar Lima Uniform. Paul's been sending articles to us and looking at those. Sheila would love to be able to blog on some of these things. Paul's found a lot of different conspiracy theories and various things that are being in part of the news right now. There's lots of stuff, a lot of things being claimed. And, you know, science moves slowly. Let me just tell you this as an introduction that that's unfortunately it's kind of the way it is. We have to, it would be nice to be able to say, let's just try everything and see if it works, you know. But the question really is, let's see if it works. If it works on one person, that isn't really any kind of proof. That's an anecdotal thing. Okay, it's called anecdotal evidence. And if you, you know, get a few people, you might say that something works on. Then that might prompt a preliminary study. You might, those things oftentimes are put into the medical journals as letters, like the New England Journal of Medicine will have a letter, or the JAMA will have a letter. They'll say, you know, I saw, you know, 10 cases with this, and I think that something's going on here, and that might prompt a review in a medical journal. And then they might go on and study something further. Now, for this COVID, remember, everybody in the world is worried about COVID. There are people studying this stuff all over the place. They're trying to get vaccines going. They're testing those. They're testing treatments everywhere, okay? But how long has it been? It's really only been, you know, since December that we even started to hear about this thing. We really didn't hear much about it here until January. So if it really started, you know, back in November or December, you know, we're really only 4 months into it. You know, it takes a long time to get results back from studies, okay? So let's talk a little bit. You know, so that's not much fun, I should mention, for the news agencies who like to keep you all interested and excited. So people are putting out what are called preliminary studies versus peer-reviewed studies. So everybody understand what the difference between a peer-reviewed study and a preliminary study is, right? Okay, so like for example, today's news is you know, interesting because they said, okay, Stanford study. I'll take this one here. Shows the headline here is shows herd immunity is a long way off. Well, first of all, you have to look at the title of, and this is from KSBW News 8, which is somewhere down in California. Okay, so when you look at a headline, remember headlines are written by editors, and editors love to have your attention. So that, you know, you have to look at the headline and go, well, wait a minute here, and then you have to look to see what is the study. Okay, so you know, it's hopefully they'll give you a link to that study. Yeah, there's no links on radio broadcasts that, so you really can't go look at the study yourself. But in this case. Yeah, so if you go to find the study from this, what you find out, first of all, it says this article is a preprint, has not been peer-reviewed. What does this mean? Okay, it reports of new medical research that has yet to be evaluated and should not be used to guide clinical practice. Gee, I guess the headline didn't mention that, did it? So that's at least the journal people mentioned that. So it says, what is an unreferred preprint? Okay, so it says, so traditionally, you know, medical articles and science articles are certified by peer review. You know, the editors, called referees, they look at the paper and they identify any weaknesses in it, you know, its methods, its conclusions, you know, its study design, and then they oftentimes, and I've done this when I was trying to publish things, they will send it back to you and say, well, you know, that's great, but, you know, we're not convinced. You know, go or please explain how you got this result. Or maybe you should go try doing some more. And because that process of sending it and having it reviewed by, you know, usually a minimum of three different editors, before, you know, they have a backlog of things to read, that takes a good month or two turnaround time if you're lucky. Okay, then you get it back, and then you make your edits, and then you, you know, or if it requires more research, you got to do it again. Okay, and then you send it back. And the, believe me, the second time you send it back, it better be right if you want to get it published. If not, they will just reject it. Okay, if you haven't fixed the problem, they'll just say, thank you, but no thank you, and you better go try somewhere else. So that's the way peer review normally works. So you can see, and that doesn't work very well with our news cycle. At any rate, let's talk a little bit about what the conclusion is of the Stanford study. So Stanford apparently, and I'm not going to go into all the details, but the point is that we're very excited right now because we're interested in antibodies, okay, antibody testing, antibodies in particular to COVID-19, okay? So the big question is, okay, for all of us is that, oh, well, especially if we find out that not everybody has symptoms that gets COVID. Some people get COVID and that they really don't really know much symptoms at all. And we know the most about the people that were on the cruise ships. The cruise ships all got tested. So those cruise ship people, we found out that, yeah, there was a significant number of people, nearly half the people, who really didn't show any symptoms, and yet they had the virus in them. The test showed it positive. Now, there are some, two things to remember when you do a test. There's false positives and false negatives, okay? So false positive is incorrectly identifying a person who is infected, and a false negative is missing it. Missing the fact that they have the infection. Okay, so both of those happen with any kind of test that we do, false positives and false negatives. Okay, so next thing that you have to figure out is, okay, all right, so you're testing something, you have an idea, and I did this in science too, you come up with a technique, a method, a protocol, whatever you want to call it, and you decide, okay, I'm going to, who am I going to study, and how many people can I study? And if you're doing human studies, you actually have to get big approvals from on human studies that you're not going to harm those individuals. And usually if it's a university, you have to go through another committee process to do that. Well, anyway, this one was pretty good in the sense that they went out and they, recruited a bunch of people, 3,330 people, which is a lot of people. And then they... a variety of zip codes, sex, race, adjusted for, some things of different manufacturers that, trying to estimate the number of positive and negative controls. At any rate, what we're looking for is we're trying to figure out, okay, what happens with antibodies? We want to know, do you have antibodies to COVID? So let's just back up one bit here and let's talk about antibodies. Now Paul sent me a good article that was from OPB about antibody testing, opb.org, and if you want to read a little bit about that, it's just their first look section. That's talking about antibody testing coming to Oregon with coronavirus front lines, with big caveats. Okay, but it has a good introduction to antibodies, and if you want to look at that. And essentially what happens is that when you have your immune system has sort of two phases, a more generalized phase where it tries to fight things in general. You have an inflammatory response and you produce some general types of antibodies. And then after a while, your body produces very specific kinds of antibodies, a different type. And so these the ones that we're looking for that we'd be most interested in are the ones that are specific to the COVID-19 virus. Okay, so again, so if you're trying to find an antibody, you can find, except anybody with any kind of inflammation at all, is probably, we all have antibodies floating around. And if we've been exposed to a virus in the past, or we've been vaccinated against a virus, one of the really cool things that our body does is it has these cells that are hanging around, and they're basically waiting to be activated. They get activated by the inflammatory process, and sort of through the miracle of the body here, those those cells start to divide that produce the antibodies that we need to fight off the infection, and they make a bunch of them really quickly, so they're ready to go, and they can then fight off the infection. The antibodies work by basically binding to proteins on a virus or a bacteria, and they cause them to sort of clump and get identified by other types of cells, macrophages are called, that come along and chomp up the clumps of invaders, and that helps us get rid of our infection. So for some things that we get, you know, like our general colds and things like that, that we don't have, these specific antibodies, we still have a good immune response. If you have, you know, you're healthy and have a good immune system, you will fight off, you know, general infections with our general thing. But you may or may not actually come up with the specific types of antibodies that against that infection, which would give you immunity. Immunity is when you have these cells hanging around ready to be mobilized when you get infected again. So, okay, so you understand a little bit. That's a basic understanding of the way immunity works there. Okay, so if you did have those specific cells, then the idea, we still don't know yet, because that's new science, right? We need to be able to study people who have recovered from the illness and, you know, see what, if they've made these antibodies. And then we also have to follow those people over time and make sure that they don't get infected again. Okay, that's when we're going to know whether someone is immune, okay? So let's just stop there and see if that all makes sense to people so far. Okay, so let's talk about a little bit about what's the problem, okay? All right, so let's say we have a test, okay, and they give some examples here. So I'm going to talk a little bit of numbers. If you get lost, just stop me and ask for Phil. But they give an example. They said, let's say we have a particularly good test, okay? A particularly good test, they have two things that we're worried about. One thing's called sensitivity, and the other thing's called specificity. So let's say, so they give an example. Say you had 100,000 people, you know, and, you know, you wanted to test them. And let's say, you know, they give an example. Say 2% of the people caught a virus, and you wanted to see if they had antibodies against it, okay? And you use a test that's supposed to be pretty good. It's a sensitivity of 97%. That means it would accurately diagnose those 97% of those people that had antibodies, okay? And then they talk about the specificity, and they said, and it also has, let's say, a specificity of 95%, means that it would accurately diagnose 95% of those people without antibodies, okay? So we want to be able to test the ones that do and the ones that don't, okay? So those are the two things. So now, of those 2,000 people, or sorry, that... of those 100,000 people, of those 2,000 people, sorry, if you talk about the 97% of those 2,000 people in our population would get a true positive, right? So that would mean that, you know, 1,940 people it's would have it, and you could say, yep, I got it, and 60 people would be false negative. That means that they've incorrectly identified them as having the antibody. Okay, that's a really good test. Okay, but then what about, let's say we could test all these people, okay? Remember, we're trying to test 100,000 people now. Okay, 98,000 of those people are not infected, right? So this is where the numbers get big. So now, it has that specificity of 95%. So that means that 93,100 people would get a true negative. You would say, yep, they really didn't have it. But the concern is false positives. So they, unfortunately, 4,000 of those people would be identified as having had the virus, even though they were never infected. Does that make sense? Okay, so then they go on to say, so what is that those false negatives going to do, the false positives going to do to our results? And I said, so again, you have this 100,000 people that you're testing. You know, you've got only 1,940 of the 6,840 positive results would be correct. Okay? Because of, remember, that false positive rate of the other one. So that ends up being 6,840 positive results, okay? But only 1,940 are correct. That's only 1 in 4. So the problem is if we undercount, like I said in Oregon, if we undercount in cases by a factor of 10, only about 3% of our population would have been infected. So the false positive rate is higher. So that's the problem, you start testing everyone with a test that's even that accurate, and you're going to get a whole bunch of people who are going to show, oh, you got antibodies. And that's this test that we've developed. We really don't know. I've heard numbers is 20% wrong. So, and that may be worse, depending. We've approved a lot of tests that have not gone through any kind of validation. So validation is the other term you guys need to know about.
K6SDX.
Okay, yeah, go ahead, Dan.
Well, if you come up with this many, like, false positives, and then what are we going to do? We're going to quarantine these people for maybe 2 weeks. And if these people are the wage earners of the family, they're going to get stuck and get taken out of a job. And it turned out that they never had it to begin with. I mean, who's going to enforce this kind of stuff that, you know, it sounds like it's going to screw everybody up a lot.
JCD.
Yeah, let me just make one comment. But so when they find the antibodies in this case, they're actually going to say, oh, you had COVID. So therefore, that would be the problem with the false positive. This is not an antibody test to see if you're sick. This is an antibody test to see if you had previously been exposed and had antibodies to the COVID. So the problem would be that these people wouldn't be quarantined. They would be freed to go back to work. You'd say, oh, well, you guys can go to work because you obviously already have the antibodies. Go ahead, John.
Yeah, that's the issue. When government uses a test that's not 100% accurate to make a, you know, final judgment.
Yeah, so the next part of it is really when we design one of these things is that, you know, okay, so Sheila wanted to mention this, it's important that your individual result, you know, what happens to you is subject to some rate of success, right? Depending on the accuracy of the test. It is not a good tool to say this person is cleared for work, okay? Because you can see how that would be, you know, if you look at it in general. Here's the next step. Here's what we have to do. It's something called validation, okay? This is what they are trying to do. And it was a report today that I think it was Kaiser was going to test 2,000 health workers, okay? And then do the test. Now, see the difference between that test and the one in Stanford. Stanford tested random people in the community, and their conclusion of their test was they found 3 to almost 5% of the people had antibodies. Okay, so then they were saying that in Santa Clara, where there's a lot of people, that meant there was like 85,000 people, you know, who possibly were walking around with COVID antibodies, and that isn't as many as they've even tested there. Okay, so that was the improper conclusion of that is that, wow, you know, we estimate that there could be all these people walking around with antibodies. Well, again, that would affect policy. You'd say, well, if there's that many people walking around with it, you know, then, you know, what problem do we have? I mean, there's a lot of people that would be, you know, able to work and stuff. So let's just open everything back up. Okay. That's the problem. Again, looking at the paper, it says don't use this for medical advice. It hasn't been proven. So here's the other study that they talked about is let's look at healthcare workers. So take 2,000 healthcare workers and let's give them all the COVID antibody, or sorry, the COVID viral test first, you know, and then we'll check and see if they have antibodies. Okay, so that would be different because now we have a way of something called validating. Now, our tests are not perfect. Again, there might be 20% or so that get missed by the test, but you know, if you take the ones that are positive and then you give them the antibody test, you could say, start to get an idea of, well, how accurate is this test? We would hope that the vast majority of the people who had really tested positive for COVID would then end up with antibodies. Does that make sense? So this is Kilo Golf 7, Golf Delta Brava, and we're talking a little bit about some of the new stuff as far as, you know, antibody testing. So yeah, you'd like to go out there and you'd like to say, hey, I was sick, you know, in January. Maybe I had COVID. Maybe I'm immune to COVID. Well, that would be great, you know. But the problem is, if our test is showing false positives and they sort of randomly test people, you know, it really actually should be done in conjunction with the COVID test. If we could test enough people with COVID to get an idea of really how many people are truly infected, you know, and could match those results up with the antibody thing, then we get an idea of the sensitivity and specificity of our test. And if we get those numbers real high, then you might be able to say, in general, you know, how many people have really been infected and who might be immune. So last thing Dan mentioned, let me stop there for a second. Let's just see if there's any more questions. I know it's a lot of numbers.
RGM.
Yeah, go ahead, Reiner.
Basically, what you're saying means that even with very small margins of errors, there could be a significant number of people who test positive or negative that shouldn't be allowed in or should be allowed back into basic non-quarantine conditions.
Yep. So, you know, I mean, the thing is, I don't know that you can really say at this point in time that anyone is really immune yet because it hasn't been long enough to see if you're going to be immune. So I don't think the antibodies are going to be helpful to us right now to help us open up, you know, the workplaces. So, again, we need a different strategy. First of all, we need a strategy where we could test people. If you could test for the presence of the virus and then take people who had the virus through testing, say, okay, you want to go back to work, you get tested for the virus, and you say, okay, yeah, you didn't, you know, again, we miss it sometimes, but if you did tested people that aren't showing symptoms and you could tell, well, okay, yeah, what is the true infectivity rate? We can get an idea, first of all, you know, how many people are we really talking about here in our area? If you did find somebody who's positive, you do the next step, which we're starting to talk about, which is to do contact tracing. So this is what we have to do. We test people who are suspicious, and then we do the contact tracing, and then we tell those people, hey, you need to quarantine for 14 days, see what happens. We need to get everybody you've been in contact with, because you tested positive, 14 days, and isolate them. In the meantime, you know, we've taken you out of the mix, and we'll follow up with you and see that you get better. And the way that they've been doing it, same, if you have two negative tests after having the illness, then you're cleared to go back to work. That takes a while, but that does take those people who are infected out of the population, and you also can check other people that they've been exposed to and make sure that they're not getting sick. So, yes, that's the painful part of what they call a contact tracing, and that's how you – it's called containment. And that's besides doing what we're doing now, which is mitigation and social distancing, containment is supposed to be the next step. And we can do that if we can quickly pounce and test and get – and really get an idea and take those people away from exposing others.
RGM.
Yeah, Reiner, go ahead.
Well, you were just saying a minute ago that 20% of these tests are producing a false negative. So one in five people you could be potentially sending out there to infect everybody else that's either tested through it or, you know, we don't know if, at this point if they can re-catch it. So, yeah, it's just, it doesn't seem like we're close enough to do anything at this point.
K7JCD.
Yeah, John, go ahead, please.
Yeah, at some point we're just going to have to accept a certain amount of risk.
Yep. So, okay, Dan had a question earlier tonight about the herd immunity thing, and let me just cover that real quick because we're almost out of time, but this is what people are concerned about. So if we start saying that, oh, well, there's a whole bunch of people out there, you look at this Stanford study and you say, what about herd immunity, okay? All right, so double check with Sheila. Sheila says herd immunity happens when the R value, the infectivity rate, goes below 1, okay? When it gets below 1, then the virus dies out. Okay, that means it's not an infected person infects less than one person. Now, again, COVID's supposed to be around 2 people for every one person that gets infected, and the flu is supposed to be about 1.1 persons, okay? There were other things like measles in the past that are much, much higher R values. I think the R value for measles is like 10, if I'm remembering right. Smallpox, really high R values. And so, again, we have vaccines for those things. We don't worry about them. So what vaccine, does is get large numbers of people to be immune. And so this herd immunity protects people who are not infected. So right now, if our estimates are right, if you even just take the Santa Clara and say, I believe it, 3% of the people to 4% of the people out there are infected with COVID, okay, that still leaves 97% of the people out there who don't have COVID, have not been exposed to it, okay? So how many people do you need to have herd immunity? It's around 60% of the population needs to have, test positive, have had it and got it and got over it in order for the rest of us to be safe.
K7MJB.
Yeah, Mike, go ahead.
Hope you can hear me real good on my handheld, but something's been kind of going through my head today. If business introduces a new product, they kind of put out feelers and stuff to see what the reaction is in that.
Yep, test marketing. Go ahead.
Yeah, now, there will be so many failures and stuff in the test marketing and some people will like and they'll get a feeling of what is going on. And they'll get a reaction of the public. Now, what if this coronavirus that started in another country, they just put this out as kind of a feeler to see how the world would react. It doesn't have much of a, according to all science, it doesn't have much of a infection rate, but it's pretty robust. But anyway, they just put it out for a feeler to see how nations and healthcare and everything would react, because maybe they're planning to pump something up that's going to come in like measles and going to take 20-30% of the population out in a later time. That's my conspiracy theory.
Yep, KG7GDB. Well, there's lots of conspiracy theories, but you know, it just happens. You know, in this case, I think the evidence is that this it's bad enough that it just happened. Okay, it doesn't have to be malicious intent. People have studied this stuff, and this is what happens with a novel, a novel virus, and the experts have predicted it. And again, Sheila, one of the reasons she knows this stuff is that they talked about it in Oregon. We had plans for this. She was on the committee back in 2015. We talked about what would happen if there was a pandemic, and they had the H1N1 infection that came out, and that everybody got geared up, and we actually had a lot of programs and things that were in place that we tried to make plans for, and we didn't really implement those plans, when we found out about this one, and that delayed it, and so, the effect was much worse with global travel, and, we closed down our borders, but, 60,000 people still arrived from China after the borders were closed, theoretically, so we didn't do a very good job of that, closing things down, so there's not much you can do when you have a very, very active, mobile population, and you have an illness that doesn't manifest itself in too bad of symptoms right away. We're not massively becoming sick in 2 days, and wasn't a way to sort of take temperatures and screen people. All those things were not effective. So anyway, our social distancing, as you can see, kind of works, and we're the country in general is slowing down on the infectivity rate, which is great, and that's great. But the question is, we haven't done much else, except for kind of think about, maybe we should get an antibody test. And, people are working on it, but we don't have anything really tangible to give you yet. There's no good treatment. The treatments are still not proving effective. People are still getting sick, and enough people, it's not just the older people that are getting sick. The people are getting sick. That are middle-aged people, and there are some risk factors that racial factors, level of obesity, things like that seem to make it worse than others. But it's enough. It's enough to mess things up. And if we had not done what we did, we would have really knocked out our healthcare system. So at least we got ourselves a little time. But we've got to do the next step in order to get through this. And when we get the vaccine, boy, we've got to take it. And I hope it's a good one, and we get it soon. That's going to have to be, that's going to have to be proven safe and effective. And I've talked too much. So any final comments before I shut her down? Because we'll get Sheila back on Friday, and hopefully I've given you some things to think about tonight. Any final comments or check-ins or questions?
RGM.
Yeah, Reiner, go ahead.
Well, as to conspiracy theories, one of the things that conspiracy theories do really well is sell papers or, sell media, I should say. And we saw one from some news company. Remember what that was called, honey? Anyway, it was a new news company thing on YouTube or something. And after going through the video a couple of times, you could see huge amounts of edit cuts and things that were just blatantly, they were cherry-picking sentences and such. It sells media. That's what they're trying to do. And it's a sad thing that that's the way it is, but they're trying to make money.
Yep, you're right. And that's, we learned earlier on that there have been some articles about people who, in Eastern Europe that, where unemployment's high, and they can generate fake news, and people, and they get paid for people clicking and referring to their website. They actually make revenue for clicks. And so as long as there's an incentive to do that, and if you can get, people riled up enough to click on your site and make money on it, they're going to do that. And that's the problem. So anytime you read a headline, I would suggest very, very carefully that you go, like I did with this one, and look at the Stanford one and read about it. It doesn't say anything in that article about the herd immunity. It didn't say anything about, there was no advice. It basically had a disclaimer to not use it as advice. It just was a preliminary study. And so try to find the study that they're talking about when they say a study shows. Go see if you can find it, if that's interesting to you. But I think you'll find out that if we have a treatment or we have a good strategy that's working, people will shout it from the tops of the roofs. You know, there's a there's a good chance to be very successful here too. But I sure wish we could come up with our own cotton swabs. Apparently, that's still a big problem in our country. We can't make cotton swabs anymore to do these tests or the reagents that are available to do the tests. And that's what we really got to be working on. It's just that having good testing is really important. You just can't work with stuff that's inaccurate. And you know, if you give it credit, you know, we've dealt with the flu for a long time. We have good tests for the flu. And we have vaccines and stuff like that. We'll eventually get that way, you know, with this. It just, but we, I don't know, I have to go back historically to find out how long was it before we came up with, you know, good flu vaccines. But it's been a while. We have a lot of experience with that. And that's why when people say it's, you know, this is no worse than the flu, remember, we have a lot of experience with the flu. We're good at the flu. We have good tests. It still kills people. But people, we have the herd immunity there for the flu. So, and they still die. At any rate, that's all I can tell you tonight. Anyway, I guess I got to close this net down. Okay, so I talked overtime, but the time is now 8:11 p.m., and this concludes the 529 Emergency Preparedness Net. This net meets each Tuesday evening, and again, we'll try to come back on Friday with Sheila. But we've been meeting every Tuesday at 7 p.m. on 145.29 megahertz, and our thanks go out to Dan, WA7ABU, for the use of the repeater. Thanks to everyone who participated today and those who stood by to give us a clear channel. This is Kilo Golf 7, Golf Delta Bravo, now closing the net at 8:11. I now return the repeater to normal undirected amateur operations. KG7GDB, thank you. I'm clear.